This week, as fears of a worldwide recession loom, the International Monetary Fund has warned the worst is yet to come. How is the global economic turmoil affecting countries in Africa?
The cost of living, everything has changed.
Some nations are turning to the International Monetary Fund for help. Is it the bank of last resort? Plus, my interview with Abebe Amro Selassie from the IMF about its new report, Living on the Edge, detailing the shape of Africa's economic future. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome. I'm Hady Adams. Thank you for joining us. The International Monetary Fund warns that whatever economic pain we are feeling right now, the worst is still to come. And for households and economies worldwide, 2023 could be particularly tough. The effects of Russia's war in Ukraine are being felt just about everywhere. And so we wanted to find out how some African countries are coping. Timothy Obiezu is in Nigeria for us with this report.
As the World Bank and IMF concluded a week-long annual meeting Sunday, they called for support in sub-Saharan Africa. Like much of the globe, economic growth in the region is predicted to fall to 3.6% this year from 4.7% recorded in 2021. But at 3.2% growth rate, Nigeria is below the region's average, and the World Bank says half the country's population could slip into poverty in less than 2 months. Nigeria's recovery from COVID-19 has been slow, and the economy is confronted by huge spendings on recurrent debts, petroleum subsidies, and a currency devaluation. Russia's war in Ukraine also impacted on food and energy prices. And in September, authorities announced the country's worst inflation in nearly two decades. Some Abuja residents described the effects in their own words.
The rate of dollar rise and naira has fallen has really affected my business, and people cannot even have food to eat. The cost of living, everything has changed. What you got in the shipper rate now before is now in a very high rate. For example, like the food we eat, how much is a cup of rice, a bag of rice then? How much is it now?
That hasn't affected me very well. There's no money.
Nigeria's currently battling its worst flooding in 10 years, having a compounding effect on food security. The UN says 19 million citizens made vulnerable by conflict are now on the brink of hunger. Hundreds of thousands of barrels of crude oil, Nigeria's biggest earner, are stolen every day, despite higher oil prices this year triggered by Russia's war in Ukraine. On Friday, Central Bank Governor Godwin Emefiele told investors at the World Bank and IMF meeting to consider investing in Nigeria and Africa. But economic experts say authorities must focus on earning more money from non-oil sectors. Election rallies and campaigns for February's polls have been gaining momentum. Campaigners are focusing on insecurity and the country's economy, and many say there's a big task ahead for whoever emerges as president. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Timothy, thank you. Ghana, for example, has seen its currency, the cedi, slump, overtaking Sri Lanka's rupee as the worst performing currency in the world. The West African country has been in talks with the IMF on a debt relief deal as authorities they are trying to keep the economy afloat. David Doyle from Reuters has more.
Ghana's finance ministry said on Tuesday that it's formed a committee with the central bank. The aim is to lead discussions with the financial services industry concerning an international monetary fund program. A statement said the goal of the five-member committee is to ensure confidence in the government's ongoing negotiations with the IMF. It added that a similar engagement will be undertaken concerning external bondholders. Ghana approached the IMF for financial support in July as foreign investors dumped its debt and street protests broke out over rocketing prices. The cedi currency is down around 40% against the dollar this year. That decline has slowed, aided by the disbursement of a $750 million loan from Afrexim Bank and the signing of a $1.13 billion syndicated cocoa loan. Inflation, however, climbed to a 21-year peak of 33.9% in August. Amid the rapidly deteriorating economy, the Bank of Ghana last Thursday hiked its main lending rate a further 250 basis points to a five-year high of 24.5%. An IMF team was in Ghana last week for talks about the potential loan program. The IMF said on Friday that its team would return to Washington for further technical work, including assessing the West African country's debt sustainability.
Well, David Doyle of Reuters filing that report for us. Well, here in Washington, economic leaders have wrapped up a week of discussions around the state of the global economy at the World Bank International Monetary Fund's annual meetings. The IMF has released a report called Living on the Edge, detailing sub-Saharan Africa's economic outlook. I sat down with the fund's Abebe Amro Selassie to discuss the region's economic future and ways countries can recover.
The International Monetary Fund has released its sub-Saharan economic outlook report. It's called Living on the Edge. What do you mean by living on the edge? On the edge of what?
It's a very good question. So overall, I think a fairly difficult time for the region. Thankfully, countries were not hit as bad by the health effects of the pandemic. But of course, the economic toll on the region was really awful. And last year, finally, the region was beginning to put, you know, the full effects of the pandemic behind it and beginning to grow. And we saw growth accelerating to 4.1%. But this year that has, you know, reversed. And so we are projecting growth to decelerate, to slow to 3.6%. So really difficult. And in a region which needs to grow by 7-8%, honestly, to make a difference in poverty reduction, address, you know, the improvements in living standards that are needed, this decline is really awful and really points to a very difficult year. And we've characterized it as living on the edge because really households, families really are exhausting their buffers. And in fact, we are actually seeing food insecurity increasing in some parts of the region. And when you look at the situation of many governments' finances, many, not all, I should stress, you're seeing a lot of strains. Governments, you know, not having enough resources to be able to, not enough resources to be able to continue spending on health, education, exactly because they are facing a lot of short-term pressures from needing to provide more food imports, needing to, you know, facing very high food import bills. So we wanted to paint a picture where countries are exhausting all their buffers, all their resources, and reaching, you know, the end of their tethers, as it were.
You also say 19 of Africa's 35 low-income countries are in debt distress or at high risk of distress. Now, some countries, of course, turn to the IMF for help, but not all of them have done so. Why are some countries doing it, and why are some countries not turning to the IMF? Are there requirements they do not meet?
You know, it's a good question. First and foremost, I mean, you know, we're there to help countries when conditions are really difficult or when they come to support us. There's no obligation for countries to come and use the financing that we can provide. But importantly, short of that, we do engage with countries in a lot of other ways. Policy advice, so we have a lot of countries in that setting. But we also provide a lot of capacity development support, you know, how to strengthen central banks, how to put in place a better tax policy environment so governments can provide more resources. Now, but when countries are faced with a difficult circumstance, you know, they do turn to us because we are, you know, we would provide by far the cheapest source of financing that is available. There are a few countries where engagement is difficult as a result of, you know, political transition issues or, you know, debt being unsustainable. But even in those cases, you know, provided they have requested support, we are working with them actively. So it's a matter of time when we can address the debt issue before we can present the program to the board. Addressing debt issues when it's clearly unsustainable is important because, you know, otherwise the resources we provide will go towards servicing unsustainable debt rather than helping the country. And we, of course, want the country to be helped. It's very important that debt issues are addressed up front as soon as it's clear that debt is unsustainable.
What are the signs that a country is in debt distress?
This is an assessment done on a country-specific basis and, you know, taking into account what the outlook, growth outlook is, you know, prospects for the economy, prospects for income. So we do something called a debt sustainability analysis in each country case when a country asks for support. It's on the basis of that we, have a discussion about, you know, where the debt pressures are. So one indicator, for example, is the share of tax revenues that goes towards servicing debt. Is it, you know, reasonable or not? Because, you know, the higher the share of revenue that the government uses to pay debt, it crowds out spending on health, on education, infrastructure. So that's why kind of you know, there are a series of indicators like this, and it's both looking at the numbers, but also judgment is involved. Yeah? Will the government be able to address this through new tax measures? So, quite a few variables that have to be taken
into. What are those tax measures? What are you looking, should countries be looking at taxing? Luxury goods, exports?
You know, taxation is spending too, is a deeply domestic and deeply political issue. What we identify really is, you know, when we work with countries, you know, how much potential tax collection, the scope for tax collection is, and you know, are they approaching that potential? What might be the factors that are not there? But in terms of, you know, like, you know, what the balance of tax handles they want to use, of course, I think is a deeply domestic thing. Now, we do want, you know, there are basic principles that are really important to adhere to. So I think taxes need to be, equitable and, you know, progressive. Why? Because we've seen countries with regressive taxes or where income inequality is high, not growing so rapidly, being unstable, you know, which comes back to, of course, affect fiscal balances. So there are certain principles like the efficiency of the tax system, the fact that it's progressive and equitable, the fact that it's acceptable to everybody. There are certain principles that, of course, are important, but really fundamentally it's going to be up to countries. And, of course, there's a lot of country specificity as to what tax handles would make the most sense.
Are there some African countries that will simply never be in a position where they could get an IMF loan for help?
It's difficult for me to think that. I mean, so the reason countries turn to us is either when they face kind of, you know, like a severe shock in the context of the pandemic, or a lot of countries that normally wouldn't come to the IMF came to us. Why? Because markets were shut down, because, you know, the crisis was really an acute, you know, once in a 100-year shock. So when you have shocks like that, or even smaller and country-specific shocks, countries turn to us. Going forward, we now have a new facility called the Resilience and Sustainability Trust, which has been created through the rechanneling of SDRs from richer countries to countries that need the resources more. And the purpose behind this Resilience and Sustainability Trust, which, you know, most middle-income and low-income countries are eligible to, is to help address, pandemic preparedness and climate change issues in the long term. So, this is a new instrument that we're looking to use to support our countries to increase resilience. I think that's one of the key things that's emerging from the lessons of the last couple of years, that climate change in particular cannot wait. Okay, these low frequency events like pandemics, which we think will never happen, do happen, and when they happen, they create huge issues. So, that's also another area we're working with and hope to work with many more countries in the coming years.
Is the IMF the bank of last resort?
Some people do describe us like that, and for sovereigns that are in a difficult position, we are indeed the entity that they tend to turn to us. And again, that's why we were created.
And you're saying to countries, come to us for help
when they need it. Absolutely.
And you've outlined four priorities for policymakers in Africa going forward. You may have alluded to some of these earlier in the conversation, but can you briefly share with us those recommendations?
Absolutely. So, you know, right now, of course, you know, social protection, addressing the pressures, cost of living increase that our people are facing right now, and outright food insecurity, you know, which has gone up in many cases, either because of particular shocks. So in the Horn, in the Sahel, we've seen, you know, really distressing situation with food insecurity increasing very sharply. So addressing that is really important, and governments need to do what they have to do to make sure that, you know, they intervene to support people. So I think we think that's an important priority. Second, inflation has accelerated in the region and the vast majority of countries. So this also needs to be addressed head on. Now, I think it's a sign of the progress that the region has made that, honestly, inflation has not been an issue for 15, 16 years in the vast majority of countries. It used to, of course, in the 80s, 90s, even through the mid-2000s, it was a big issue in many countries. But of late, you know, policies have been conducted well. But now we're seeing inflation emerging as a big issue, and I think central banks need to be a lot more focused on addressing inflation. Why is inflation important? Again, it is an insidious tax which undermines and, you know, undercuts the incomes of the poorest people often, who live on fixed incomes, are unable to escape this inflation tax. So it really is not just a technical issue, but really something that goes to the issue of the cost of living. A third priority, I think, is for governments to increasingly look for ways to make sure that they don't, you know, tip over the edge in terms of debt sustainability challenges, because it can really compound all of the other crises that they're facing. So fiscal reforms, you know, tax revenue mobilization, if debt is already, it's clear that it's unsustainable, looking for ways to reprofile that debt. So fiscal reform is another important component of what needs to be done. And then finally, even as countries are doing this, we cannot forget about the need to build resilience, so that, you know, resilience to climatic shock type challenges, resilience to food supply shortages that we've seen. So investing perhaps a bit more on agriculture so that we have better production. So all of those issues need attention.
And that was Abebe Amro Selassie, head of the Africa Department at the International Monetary Fund, speaking to me here in Washington. Of course, you can catch the full interview on our social media platforms. Go to Facebook at VOA Straight Talk Africa, and you can also find us on YouTube. Our page is VOA Africa. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa. Should countries be turning to institutions like the IMF for help and multiple times? What are the pros and cons of doing so? Should it be the bank of last resort? My guests and I will discuss on the other side of the break. Covering the continent every day from east to west, north to south, that's VOA Africa 54. We bring you the latest news and development from Africa. Politics, health, tech, and everything in between. We're on it. Our network of reporters and analysts are on hand to add perspective to all our reports. Join me, Esther Githui-Ewart, Monday through Friday, right here on VOA's Africa 54.
Welcome back. We're discussing the economic headwinds being felt around the world right now. The IMF says things are about to get worse. What does it all mean for African countries, especially those in debt distress or at risk of debt distress? And some are turning to the IMF for debt relief. Is that a good thing? And what are the pros and cons of doing so? If you're streaming with us on Facebook, you're welcome to comment right now and share your views. But joining me here to discuss this, as well as what came out of the annual meetings, is Joel Kibazo. He is a partner at JK Associates. He joins us from VOA Studios in London. And with me here in studio is VOA's Abby Sun. She covered the recent World Bank IMF meetings here in Washington. Joel and Abby, a warm welcome to you both. Thank you for giving us your time.
Well, thank you so much.
Abby, I'm going to start with you. You covered the IMF annual meetings. You spoke to many African finance ministers. What was the main takeaway for you coming out of that meeting?
Well, Heidi, I'm not going to sugarcoating this one, because if you spend 4 days at the meetings, you will understand, you know, it does paint a very gloomy picture for the forecast. You know, as people talk about this year, from the world economic outlook released from International Monetary Fund, it predicts the global growth to slow down from 6% last year to 3.2% this year and 2.7% next year. And on top of that, we're experiencing very high inflation. So overall, it's really not looking good. So I think that's why there's a lot of talk because about that restructuring or debt relief, because it does affect African countries much more severely than developed countries.
Well, yes, and for sure, just to be clear, we are feeling the effects of inflation the world over. Of course, we cover Africa, so that's, of course, our focus today. Joel, welcome to the discussion here. Can you outline for us what are the pros and cons for countries, especially African countries, of turning to an institution like the IMF for help and doing so multiple times?
Well, the first thing, Heidi, the first thing I need to say to you is that African countries are members of the IMF, so they're not going to some external body that they don't know. This is an institution that partly belongs to them, along with many other sort of countries all over around the world. I mean, the IMF has 190 members, just to give you a perspective. Secondly, in terms of going to the IMF, as Abebe mentioned in his interview with you, it is a cheap way. It's the cheapest source of finance for most governments. If you were to go elsewhere, there would be, particularly if you're going to go down the private route, there'll be a lot of the expense that you would incur in borrowing that money that you need to help you through a difficult period would be that much greater than the terms under which you would get through the IMF. That is perhaps the biggest sort of benefit. Thirdly, increasingly the IMF is sympathetic in many ways. So for instance, increasingly they look at, you know, how much money will be able to go to the poorest members of society. There's also increasing dialogue with the government that is borrowing. And it also takes in things like the private sector. What is the view? Now, the negatives, you may say, what are those negatives? It is a challenge. They will say, what is it that you're going to cut? Because there's no such thing as a free lunch. And so, and also increasingly, you will have to adhere to the program that has been set by the IMF. And so discipline is perhaps the word that I'm looking for, that there needs to be going in. So you don't go to the IMF if you're not prepared to understand and actually adhere to the conditions that have been set by the lender.
And Joel, talking about what you have to do in return for all this money from the IMF, I think that is what paints perceptions on the continent. Look, I come from a country where the IMF, I come from South Africa, and the IMF isn't really something that's part of the national discourse. But I found it interesting that in some countries, like Zambia, for example, people have a very clear idea of the IMF and what it's done, but particularly the history of the IMF in many African countries. We're talking here about structural adjustment programs, the conditionalities. What right now, in your view, is the perception amongst ordinary people of the IMF? And what do we get wrong and what do we get right about how the IMF is viewed in many African countries?
Heidi, let me just say this. I mean, I spent many years as a financial journalist going in and around Africa. And when I went, you know, it was, of course, during the period of structural adjustment. That's what was the bane of many African countries. And most people would tell you, we are poor because of structural adjustment and the policies of the IMF. Now, the truth of the matter was that's what politicians in each of our countries does. And they then blame the IMF rather than saying that they, in charge of government expenditure and government resources, are the ones that have found themselves in that situation. Secondly, that the IMF has, to be fair, also was perhaps a bit strict in its ways of handling things. And as I mentioned before, increasingly now it looks to also have a dialogue with the government to see what program they should be sort of instituting. At the end of the day, we can see the benefits of this. If we take an example such as Zambia, Zambia in 2020 defaulted on its debt. Zambia in 2020, if you now look at Zambia in 2022, it has perhaps one of the strongest currencies on the continent. It has a favorable outlook because it's just agreed and it had an agreement with the IMF, and money is going to be dispersed. And so what you then find that actually, if you do adhere to discipline and actually have a discussion about what will be done, the IMF is prepared to listen, and increasingly, IMF also wants to protect social programs. Abebe also talked about the environment. I mean, they're very well aware. So this is what people have to understand. It's not, the IMF is not some old bogey sitting out there. It is something that the countries are members of. And at the end of the day, it is trying to assist a country get back on its feet and to be able to manage its economy in the most efficient way.
I really like your turns of phrase, Joel. But I just want to ask you one more along those lines, about the IMF and its relationship with African countries or on the continent, if we take a sort of broader view. Of course, in the past, countries have had to make economic reforms in order to have access to the money from the IMF. But has the IMF itself had to do a lot of reforming?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, the IMF itself, as I mentioned before, has reformed. I think it was rather strict in the way in which it would sort of set terms. Increasingly, what the approach has been asking the governments, you know, those that go to the IMF, what would you do? What are the things that you can make your adjustments from? So there is that greater dialogue, which has actually made in other words, the IMF is a lot more friendly. And it's also shown that it actually is keen on protecting programs that affect the poorest in society. That has made things a lot easier for local governments to be able to articulate that the program at least protects A, B, and C that affects the poorest, but we're going to have to make adjustments on expenditure. Quick example, when you see a president flying a commercial aircraft rather than having to take aircraft, maybe that's a sign that you are adjusting your spending, and the IMF and other institutions, of course, respond to things like that.
I've got very little time here, but I want to get two more questions in. Abby, for you, one on the Zambian finance minister who you spoke to. What was he telling you about what are the next steps for them now?
I think it's very essential for Zambia to go through this process of debt restructuring and get the terms right. Otherwise, they're going to be, extended another 3 years or go through another one. So I talked to the minister of finance and I got, please a satisfied answer because he mentioned we want to invest in social spending. Education is a top one, and that will take some time. Meanwhile, we invest in other industries can generate jobs to boost the economy. When it happens, you have both tools to work together, complementary, to help the country and the economy, walking out of poverty. So.
Well, this is really a deep conversation that I would like to have again. Joel, please do join us again on Straight Talk Africa. It was such a great pleasure to have you. Same with you, Abby Sun. Thank you to both of you for your time. I really do appreciate it. Well, that is our show this week. A huge thank you to all my guests and our contributors. Thanks to our affiliates for bringing you Straight Talk Africa throughout the African continent. And of course, we're grateful to you for joining us on television, radio, and online. From all of us here in Washington, until the next time, it's goodbye.